Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to Weavecast, episode 45. This episode, Anna Zinsmeister brings us another wonderful interview. This time she talks with Michael Rohde, who is a talented rug weaver and tapestry artist. He talks about his work, as well as how he got his start on a simple and humble rigid heddle loom. I've added a new feature to the WeaveZine site. It is an events calendar. Now, this calendar is a bit special because it is filterable by geographical region, which means that you can enter and find weaving events for any place on the planet. How cool is that? There's even color coding that's roughly by continent. The alpha testers and I have been working hard and polishing this up. It is good enough for beta, so please take it for a test drive. Enter your weaving events or your guild meetings or whatever you want. It's kind of an experiment. I don't know yet how people are going to use it, but I can't wait to find out. You can find that up on the site at weavezine.com/calendar. And just a note, you do have to be logged in order to post. Without further ado, here's Michael Rohde.
My name is Anna Zinsmeister, and I'm interviewing Michael Rohde, who's a friend of mine and also a very experienced and knowledgeable rug weaver and tapestry weaver now, and been doing it a long time. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Anna. I'm surprised and honored to interview me. I guess I should say that I've been a weaver now for more than 35 years or so, I guess. Didn't really have any family exposure to weaving. Got started weaving because of curiosity about how cloth was made, and I had seen somewhere in the early 70s someone wearing a hand-woven blouse that caught my eye, and I've often said it was probably badly made, otherwise I wouldn't have noticed it. It got my curiosity going, and for a few years I thought about it off and on, and then at some point after that I was living in Houston and had seen, I think it was a needlepoint shop. They actually had a rigid heddle loom in a box about the size of a Monopoly set. So I bought that. I was still a student, so I couldn't afford the yarns that they had. I went to Kmart and bought kite string and Orlon knitting yarn because it was inexpensive. I think the other thing that sort of influenced me into using those yarns originally was that a friend of mine had some rugs on the floor that another friend of hers in another city somewhere had woven, apparently out of the same yarns. So I think that also got me thinking about rugs at the same time. So I bought the rigid head loom in a box and the knitting yarn. I also got a copy of a Sunset Magazine book on weaving. For about the first year and a half, kind of followed that, taught myself a bit from the book, and explore different things, patterns that you could get from two-dimensional. I'm from a two-harner loom.
So were they warp and weft phase, or were they more like the rugs? Or
the very first warp I put on was weft face because I thought it would be fun to do tapestry, so I put on about a yard and a half of warp or something like that, and after I'd woven about 3 inches, I decided that was very slow and tedious, and I didn't want to do that, and I cut it off, and so here was this 2 or 3 inch weaving with a yard of fringe hanging. And a good friend of mine bought it as a present for one of her relatives. Oh.
So you started out doing tapestry, really?
Yes.
You sort of come full circle.
Yeah. So then a couple times I tried to make a shirt or a blouse from that little rigid head of loom, which wasn't much more than about 18 inches wide. And so not knowing enough about shrinkage during weaving.
Right.
I said, well, I'll be able to do this. So I wove it with a slit for the neck, and, you know, so it could be folded over and put together. And then, of course, by the time it came off the loom, and I don't even know if I had washed it, I realized it was too small to wear for somebody.
Oh, well. It was a start. I think all of us get in that experimental time. Yeah. Where you're learning a lot. It's really exciting.
Well, it is exciting because it's something entirely new to you unless you've had experience before, and you're willing to try things that you wouldn't have otherwise. Somewhere along that point, I must have found a weaving supply shop because I wound up making first successful piece of clothing I made was for another friend, and it was a Ruana, and I think I was using some Harrisville yarns because I remember the yarns were really lovely in terms of color and sheen and everything. And so that was easy enough to do because you could make it with a couple of strips and then piece them together, and then it wound up being a much bigger garment that would actually cover a real person on them.
So this was still on the rigid head on them?
Yeah, I'm fairly certain it was. I'm trying to remember when that was because it was for a friend in Houston. I don't think it was after I'd moved to North Carolina, but by the time I moved to North Carolina then, I found looms and loom parts for sale at flea markets and found a floor loom made out of 2x4s and spare parts from the mills for $200 or something like that.
Wow.
200 counterbalance loom. And I bought the thing from the guy at the flea market, and I said, but I'm going to need some help getting it from Raleigh to Durham, where I lived, about 30 miles on the freeway. And so he said, oh, that's no problem. So he had a station wagon, and he strapped it to the tailgate of the station wagon. Well, the first turn onto the freeway, the loom fell off.
Oh, no.
But did no damage to it whatsoever because he pulled it so strong. And then I got it to the apartment I lived in, and I had to take it apart to get it through the door and then put it back together again. So I wove on that for a long time. Didn't know the idea of warping boards, so I wound first warp around a door. Okay, and then struggled to get it on in an even fashion. Wove a few more rug-type things with the Orlon knitting yarn. And then finally I wound up with finding a place to take some lessons. And one of them, I think, was an extension class at Duke University where they actually started more basic technique than I'd been doing, which was how to make your own rigid heddle with heavy cardboard. I think the idea was to teach us how to make a backstrap loom out of cardboard and popsicle sticks that had holes drilled in them. And so you glued all this together and you wound up with the loom. But I think it was the same person also taught a class on natural dyes, which was my first exposure to dyeing things. Oh. But it was dye stuffs that we gathered from the fields around where the workshop was taught in North Carolina. Then there was a weaving store somewhere like halfway between Durham and Chapel Hill that I took classes on a 400 loom, a little 22-inch Harrisville on Krokbrock. I did four of them that were 20 by 30.
So that's where you really started getting interested in a different kind of structure than plain weave.
Yes.
Did you eventually get a four-shaft loom?
No, because I could still buy spare parts for that loom, I wound up putting two more harnesses on that original loom. So I had four harnesses on this to figure out how to do four harness counterbalance on that loom. Probably direct tie-up rather than... I'm certain it was direct tie-up. I first started trying to sell things in a gallery in North Carolina, and did a craft show there with some of the things I'd done and sold some of the first few things there. I even remember the first large weaving I sold was like $55, but it was in the dimensions I'm showing you are probably about 3 feet by 4 feet.
Was it a rug or was it a wall piece?
It was still when I had two harnesses on there, so it was a wall hanging, and it was purple and green pick and pick and stripes and that sort of thing. But also began to find other sources for yarn. There were some mill outlet stores that had mill outlet yarns that were ones that I used for a while. Then when I moved back to Houston, became friends and familiar with other craftspeople, and a group of six or seven of us started a co-op gallery that was near Rice University and the Houston Medical Center. And we ran that for about 2 years, I think. And I was still not completely doing rugs. I was interested in other things just because we were trying to sell things. But slowly I realized that even though I made other things, the things that seemed to sell better were the rugs, and began to get recognition for making the rugs in the Houston design magazines and got commissions from decorators and design people for some rag rugs as well as some wool rugs. Bought a four harness loom that was made by Thought Products, and I had wanted to buy one of their larger looms, but that time I was interested in this must have been the late 70s. They weren't making the really large looms, the Barbara looms. And so I wound up buying something that they called a Cassandra model. And it was nice because it was, had much better harness control than I did over the one made out of the 2x4s. But it wasn't heavy enough in terms of the tension you needed for rugs, so I realized that was a problem. I still had spare harnesses and gears and things like that that I bought at the flea markets, and so I actually then built an upright four-harness loom where the harnesses had to be pulled manually at the top and then held open with a stick that I put in them. But I sort of liked the idea because then I could see the whole weaving as a piece. The beater was pivoted and had weights on it and had to be held up by a bungee cord or something really ridiculous. I have no idea.
You were really imaginative.
Well, I don't know whether you call it imaginative or naive or just dumb.
Wow.
Because it took forever to weave on a loom like that, where you had to manually open the harness, stick mm-hmm. Stick in to keep the shed open, throw the shuttle across, which is, I guess this is where I got used to using stick shuttles because that was the only way you could do something on a vertical warp. And then release the beater so it would slam down and then lift it back up again and hook under to keep it in place. So I did a fair number on that. And then must have been about 1980, I got a commission for a whole house full of rugs from a family in Houston who had a summer house in Castine, Maine. At that point, I'd been wanting to have a larger loom than I'd done. This one that I built out of the spare parts had a 5-foot weaving width, but I wanted something larger than that. With the deposit for that commission, I decided it was time to go ahead and buy an 8-foot loom from Cranbrook, and decided that's what I wanted because I was mostly weaving rugs by that time anyway. Bought the loom. I'm not sure I was aware that they had 10-foot Cranbrooks at that point. I think they weren't selling them directly, but somebody later told me that some of the Bob Kidd looms that he had specially made that were 10-foot were available and for sale, and so I almost should have had the 10-foot loom because the commission involved 2 10-foot wide rugs. So the only way I could do that was to weave them in section.
Are you sorry you didn't get the 10-foot one?
No, because I can count on my two hands the number of times I've warped it up to the full 8-foot width. Well, I did a large plane weave wall hanging 8x27 feet for a company I used to work for. That was the last full width. Actually, a couple of times I set up 2 warps side by side that were, I think, each 39 inches, something like that, and wove 2 rugs.
So that you could get them the same, or?
Well, I think the idea was maybe it would go faster if I was weaving 2 rugs in different colors but the same patterns at the same time. And I think I realized after having woven that warp off that it didn't make things any faster, so. So it was the only time I did that, but fortunately I took pictures of the lecture, right. Crazy things one does with one's looms.
I guess essentially you really haven't used the full 8.
Well, there were 3 8-foot rugs that were done, 8-foot woven rugs on that loom for that commission. There was another rag rug that was 8-foot wide that I did actually for the same client. But it's still my main loom because it's so well constructed and so strong. I have lately wished that I had a little bit different loom because I've typically, especially on a big loom like that, rather than sitting to weave, I'll stand to weave. So also because it has locking treadles, so I can open the shed and then walk from one side to the other and harnesses back and forth. But because I'm very tall, I'm 6'6", that loom, as it was originally designed, has a working height of a little less than 30 inches, I think. So it's difficult, and I hadn't realized it's difficult to be bending over quite a bit to work at that. I think maybe 10 years ago I finally figured out that maybe I should just raise it up on blocks. So I currently have it up on blocks that raise it either 6 or 8 inches, I don't remember what, which involved redoing treadle separator bars and all the tie-ups and everything, so.
Oh, yeah, because you'll push down more? Is that what you mean, or?
If I'd left the treadle bar where it was, it would have been too high. I would have really had to step quite a bit to get to the treadle.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
About 10 years ago, bought from one of the internet lists. Somebody was selling a Barbara 5 Thought Products loom that I'd always wanted, and so I said, well, I'd like to have a second loom, and I bought that. And it is does have a higher working height, and I realized mm-hmm. that my golly, this is a little less stress on the body having to bend over.
Sometimes I've read people on like the Weave Tech list where they would talk mm-hmm. about how they're short and some looms are just way too big. So yeah. you don't think about that not every loom fits everybody, you know.
Well, I didn't meet the woman that I bought the loom from. I corresponded with her. Evidently, she was short, and mm-hmm. so she had had blocks attached to the treadles so that her feet would reach them.
So. Which is just the opposite from you. I guess what I was going to ask you, too, is we talked a lot about the weaving, but not so much about the dyeing. And at some point, you started doing the dyeing on your own.
I had been exposed to the dyeing, as I said, in somewhere around 1975 in North Carolina, and didn't really take to the natural dyeing at that time. But was exposed to all the different chemical dyes that are available and began doing a little bit with that, initially with silk, because I think I was still doing some garments or I think it was a caftan that somebody wanted. And so I worked a little bit with that, with this probably Cushing dyes at that point on the silk. It wasn't until after I moved back to Houston and was beginning to work with making rugs that I noticed a really big difference in a rug that I had woven using off-the-shelf dyed yarns and a rug that I had done where I had dyed a similar color range for that rug. And to me, there was just a lot more visual interest in the ones with the hand-dyed yarns because there were some variations in the colors that weren't there. The other one was just flat and dull to me with the commercially dyed yarns, because everything was even and predictable, visually predictable. And then I did another rug where I thought about, well, what would happen if I were to start a dye pot and put in a few skeins and then take them out and then add a little bit more dye to start shifting the color from one end to the other. And so I really liked what happened in getting that kind of a gradient. It was pretty choppy in terms of color gradation. I actually sort of liked that. And so I began doing a lot with color gradients within the rugs. Sometimes just with a color gradient and a few little accent lines, but then later started doing a lot with pattern weaves where you would have, let's say, a large-scale grid, you know, little squares in the grid of about an inch or three-quarters of an inch on square. So you would have a color for the grid and then a color for the background, and then work on having a change in the color of the background and a change in the color of the grid. So you really started having ways to play with the interaction of the color from the two elements of the pattern, and did a tremendous amount with that sort of way of getting patterns and color, and did a lot with the grid pattern for, by this time I'm sure I was using the Roken Twill instead of the Croke Brock. Using Peter Collingwood's book, of course, is a primary guide for all different rug structures that he's written about. Began saying, well, what other patterns could I do with the Broken Twill if I didn't want to only be doing grids? And so I worked through a number of the more complex two-color patterns that he had in there, and some three shuttle patterns. Also worked a bit with discontinuous weft, clasp weft sort of things. You could get some pattern variation in that instead of just having an overall selvage-to-selvage pattern. Probably then the big change in the weaving style came about when I joined a guild in Los Angeles that you and I were both members of, the Designing Weavers. And this was a big impetus to change in the way I dealt with my weaving, because the purpose of the organization seemed to be to develop their members, because we always had projects that we were required to do. The year I joined, the project was that we should do something we'd never done before and a technique we'd never done before, and based on a George O'Keeffe painting. Of course, people had some idea what I had done, and so they were really perplexed that I was excited about a George O'Keeffe painting as a subject matter, because they knew that I did geometric things. But what I had remembered was that George O'Keefe did some paintings of the skyscrapers in New York, so that gave me my regular geometric pattern. When I bought the Cranbrook loom, it had 8 harnesses, but I'd always had 4 harnesses in the closet because all I ever did was the broken twill. I decided it was time to take those extra 4 harnesses out and start working with ways to do multiple harness weaving. So I started doing block weaving, which gave me tremendous freedom in terms of pattern. I no longer had to deal with small scale patterns that you got from broken twill. Could work with bigger areas of changing the color from one side to the other. I'd always been intrigued by blocks on backgrounds and did a series where I used all 8 harnesses for the weaving, and it was a summer and winter Otakate structure where we had 5 blocks assigned to colors across the loom. And then if you did that strictly as a 4 harness weave, you would have a regular checkerboard pattern that would be predictable. But I said, well, what would happen if you assigned each of those 5 blocks across the surface of the rug to a different harness? Then you could move those blocks around at will to make them either part of the contrast block pattern or part of the background. So I did a series of rugs based on that idea, which again was governed a bit by naivete and thinking that, well, it's no problem. All I need to do is change the tie-up after every
area. Oh, okay. So you have to go under the loom.
So I go under the loom, which was a real big challenge on a Cranbrook counter march loom.
Yeah, because they have all those chains.
Well, at some point I changed all those chains to Texel cords.
Oh, did you?
And arranged it so that I could do the tie-up from the bottom instead of from the top of the lower lambs. But it still meant it was something for a young person to do, younger than I am now, that you could crawl under the loom every 4 inches of weaving and change that. So at that point, I began thinking about, gee, it would be nice if I had a computer-controlled loom, but there wasn't really a commercially available computer-controlled loom that was suitable for rug weaving at that point. I had a prejudice toward counterbalance, countermarch looms, and didn't think that a jack loom would be satisfactory for the really high tension that she wanted for rugs. And so I didn't pay much attention to options that were available that were jack looms that some people thought could be used for rugs. I then began, it was at a weaver's, what do they call it, the workshops in Coopville, fiber.
Oh, the fiber forum.
Fiber forum.
Yeah.
I was at one of those workshops and I was talking with Jan Paul, I believe it was, thinking about ways of doing inlay on that. And she said, well, I've got handouts from a workshop that I took a few years ago. I'll mail them to you. Well, sure enough, she did mail them to me. I opened it and I says, wait a minute, I have these handouts. It was from a workshop, or actually a seminar that Barbara Hand had given in 1984 at the Dallas Convergence. And it was a way to transfer Thea Mormon's inlay ideas to a rug technique. And so I looked at it and I said, well, this is a good idea. I think I'll go ahead and try that. She had done it for what is referred to as a 3-end block, and I wanted to do it in the summer and winter, so I adapted the procedures for summer and winter. Began weaving that. At the same time, I was thinking about ways to do shaft switching on the Cranbrook, and so I constructed these things after one of Collingwood's sort of directions on how to do that, and put it on the loom and did one rug with it. But partly because of the way I designed it, which wasn't ideal, it was really slow and tedious, and I said, you know, I could probably do the same thing with the inlay that I'm doing with both shafts. So I took that off, and that's now sitting in the closet somewhere. It hasn't been thought about since. I've done most of the rugs with inlay, so there are a set of rugs that I've done over the years that have a big central field and then a solid border around it, and so there's a color gradient moving in both the central field and the solid border. But then there are smaller squares that are blocks of color that move around in that border area. And each of those blocks is a different color as it moves from one end of the rug. That was the basis of an article that I wrote for Madeline Vanderhoof for Handwoven in 2002, I think it was, Blocked yeah. Weave within like...
Right, was the cover article.
Well, the one that was the cover article was a 2000 article, and that was the one on that summer and winter where I did all the changes in the tie-up.
Okay.
That was the cover article.
Oh, okay, yeah. So this was a different article.
Different one, yeah. Two that I wrote for Handwoven.
So when you do the Theo-Mormon technique, and you're doing it with 8 shafts...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I know the Theo-Mormon technique, which is the one where you have... 2 separate warps mm-hmm. that are doing 2 separate things. That one's right. doing the ground and the other one's doing a tie down for the overlay.
Right.
So when you're doing it with 8, then I guess I'm not quite understanding what's happening.
With the rug I was talking about earlier, which has a big central rectangle and then a solid border around the outside. So in order to do that in the summer and winter, all you really need are 4 harnesses. The 4 harnesses would be because you've got your ground weave tie downs on 2 harnesses, and then each block is controlled by one of the other 2 harnesses. Okay. So you could do that sort of weave, just a central field and a solid border around the outside on a 4 harness loom. When you want to add the inlay, then you need 2 more harnesses,
and that would be for the other block, the pink and red blocks that you've
yes.
done here.
So then that means that rug's actually can be done on 6 harnesses. And what happens with the inlay then is that they work with the ground weave tie down together until the point where you want to add a block of inlay. And then the tie down harnesses are raised and your inlay yarn goes back and forth in the area under that.
Oh, okay. I think I see now. Okay. That's interesting. So it's a one-sided piece.
Yeah.
The back doesn't show the blocks, it's just on the one side.
Interestingly, I've had the opportunity, I went to a Northern California conference one year when Jack Lenore Larson was the keynote speaker, and they had also arranged that he would agree to do a critique of a limited number of people in a very public forum of work that they wanted to, if people would sign up ahead of time. So I said, well, let's go ahead and do that, just for curiosity. And so he, in general... liked the rug that I showed him, but what he liked the most was because the inlay is on one side, then the other side of the rug is entirely different. And so he looked at it and he says, oh, I like this. He says, you get 2 rugs for the price of one.
Funny. It's interesting how you've got 3 different gradations, actually, or maybe even more than that, going on in the rug.
Yeah, there's about 3 in there. I've always looked at other textiles as sources of ideas and inspiration. So I think some of the first inlay I did was from looking at Oriental rugs or Middle Eastern rugs, whatever. And the first of them I did, it actually had this format I talked about earlier with the central field. But then I also did one where I had inlays in the middle of the field, which were little hexagon shapes, that, mm-hmm. and I don't remember what type of rug that was. At another point, I said, well, if this central field with little inlay areas only takes 6 harnesses, then if I wanted to do a 3-color, 3-block, 3-shuttle summer and winter weave, then I could do that by only adding 1 more harness. So I could do that on 7 harnesses. So that got me to thinking about kimonos and the traditional presentation of kimonos as a body of one long strip and then of 2 short strips as the sleeves to it. I said, well, if I wanted to weave a rug, I guess I was still thinking of a rug, as a kimono shape where there was a color gradient in the body, which is longer than the arms, and a different color gradient in the arms, how would I go about doing that? And so I began thinking about, well, then that would be 3 blocks where the background would be the first block or the A block, then the body, the long body, would be the B block or the second block, and then the arms would be the third block or the C block. I did that series. I actually started that series with the idea of it being 4 seasons, so I would do 4 of them in that series from the 4 seasons. The first one I think I did was reds and greens summer. So each of these 4 kimono wound up being tied to a season of the year, of course, a place that I'd visited in Japan. I'd been to Japan one in the early 90s and had visited 4 places that impressed me a fair amount. So we had the season, the place I visited, and then some traditional technique or image or color combination from Japanese traditions. So the first one was summer with colors of summer flowers. the red and the greens were somewhat similar to the contrasting colors you get in glazes of pottery, where you get an oxblood red in one oxidation reduction condition and then a pale green in the other. So that one was summer Kyoto related to pottery glaze colors. The second one was the winter one in blues and light grays. So that's winter, like Biwa. Like Biwa is an area that has a lake that's in the shape of a Biwa, which is a loop form. But at any rate, it was very blue-like in my recollection. It may not have been. So that was winter. Then spring was thinking about irises on gold leaf folding screens. So that was kind of a yellowish green, I guess the gold background and some purple accent areas. And then the last one was fall, and that was based on a visit to Nara Deer Park in area between Kyoto and Tokyo. So after I did that, I decided that this was really awfully outrageous for a rug, and so I fell back on another set of traditional rugs and did those for a while, but they actually got some pretty good response, and the New York Gallery, Gail Martin Gallery, was able to sell one of them to the Art Institute in Chicago. And so I said, well, I really ought to do some more on this area. I'd done the accent squares at the shoulder line and at the hemlines, wool inlay. I'd often wanted to think about the idea of silk and something more reflective to contrast that with the... So I did slightly smaller kimonos. The original ones were 4 feet by 5 feet. The new ones were 4 feet by 3 feet. And so I did a set of 6 of those with wool and silk. That was probably the end of that set of kimonos. The second set of 6 kimonos was the end of doing the rugs, because at that point, Gail was saying, you know, really ought to think about making them lighter, because they're... I had sent her some very large rugs. I did some 5 foot by 8 foot rugs that I sent to her that she had for a while, and one of them was exhibited at the American Craft Museum in an exhibit that Paul Smith put together. But these things were heavy. They were, you know, 15 pounds of wool in each rug. So she said, you ought to think about doing tapestry. So I actually did another kimono that was, at this point I was working with natural dyes. And it was, this one was done in tapestry technique in the traditional 12-inch strip fashion. So I wove 4 12-inch strips that were then pieced together to make the kimono shape. I thought it was a beautiful arrangement of colors. And the donor that made the money available for the Art Institute of Chicago to purchase that piece sometime later decided that she wanted a piece of mine for her collection. Oh. She looked at that one, but it didn't fit the space that she wanted, so she wound up taking one of the prayer rug-based rugs that I'd done. But I did wind up selling that silk natural dyed kimono to a woman and a friend in Pasadena, California here. So she absolutely loved it and had to have it. So.
Well, that always feels good, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, it always makes me feel good when somebody likes it well enough to decide they want to live with it.
Yeah, I guess as opposed to a gallery. Or...
No, I'm not sure that, you know, the Chicago Art Institute has that piece. I'm not sure that they've had an opportunity to put it on public display yet, because they quite often will collect items for, especially in the textile area, for study purposes and documentation of artists' careers, and don't always have an opportunity to display everything that's in their collection, especially the textiles, because they want to rotate them for light exposure.
So at that point, you were starting to head towards tapestry, mm-hmm. and making things that were more inch per inch, closer together,
right.
So they would be lighter. Were you sticking with the kimono shape at that point?
No, it wasn't until just very recently that I did the kimono shape in a tapestry format. In 2003, I believe it was, I was invited to be one of the American artists for the Polish Triennale of Tapestry in Łódź, Poland. I'd been trying to decide what to do for that, because the woman that invited me said she had seen an exhibit that I had in Vancouver that she thought was a nice installation. It included the kimonos and some other rugs. But so I began trying to think about how I could do an installation that would be up to the standards that were expected for an international tapestry exhibition like that. We were allotted a 3-meter by 3 meter square space for wall pieces, so I could do up to a 9 foot by 9 foot rug or tapestry. As it turned out, at the same time I was trying to think about what designs I wanted to incorporate, I had taken the dog for a walk and tripped and broke my ankle, and so I knew that I was going to be challenged to be weaving at the big loom. Also was thinking about ways to get a large tapestry to Poland, because it had to be packed up and sent to him. But the thing that had the biggest influence on what I wound up doing is this was about the time the U.S. was about to invade Iraq, the second Gulf War. I personally didn't think it was a good idea. A friend of mine had been to a Buddhist fellowship meeting where someone had read a poem by June Jordan about the bombing of Iraq in the 90s and the devastation that it caused, for turning houses into bits of sand, as it were. I read the poem a number of times. It had a big effect on me, so I began thinking about, well, what if I were to weave a series of houses that started out from a very distinct house form on a contrasting background to the point where that house disappeared and became indistinguishable from the background and had small accent areas or windows that eventually one by one disappeared and went away. I really liked that process of starting with the idea first and then doing the design afterwards. Instead of a lot of the rugs that I'd done, I would do the weaving, and maybe the kimonos were the exception to that, where I would have the concept of the four seasons somewhat driving at least the color selection. So it was a tremendous spur to the creativity, I think. It gave me a very good feeling to have the idea first and do the weaving after that, concept first, as it were. So I did that. It went to Poland, and it was well displayed and well received. It was, I think, later exhibited at Woven Gallery outside of Philadelphia. And then the Art and Embassies program had some images of mine, and that was one of the ambassadors chose to have displayed at ambassador's residence in one of the countries in Africa. So that's where it is right now.
When you're working in tapestry, are you working in a traditional way? And I know you're working on the horizontal loom.
Yeah.
But you have a cartoon that you're going by and that you've drawn and you've planned out.
I've been to art school. Drawing was probably my least favorite class. In fact, I think it was the last class I took, but color and design I'd always enjoyed. In fact, when I was in art school taking the color and design class, I'd asked the instructor, I said, I'm really interested in weaving, and we have a weekly project we're supposed to do. Can I do my weekly project as a woven project? He says, sure.
Well, that's nice.
Well, it was nice, but that meant I had to do one weaving a week. So that lasted for one semester, and I went to paint. So consequently, I've never been very enamored with doing a lot of drawing on paper in terms of getting designs done, but I've always been comfortable working with the computer. So I've typically planned out any weaving that I've done with a sketch on the computer, which has allowed me to rearrange colors and shapes until I get something I like, and then print it out, and then go ahead and dye yarns that are in harmony with that idea, and then weave from there. So my sketches or cartoons come from the computer. They're printed out at a regular notebook size piece of paper, so it's not a full-scale cartoon that most tapestry weavers would use.
Gives you an idea to go by.
Yeah, it gives me an idea to go by, and then allows me a chance to rethink the idea as I start weaving and I see what's happening. And often I'll have the computer overlay a light grid on that so I can mark my progress.
There's still block patterns within that image.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you're carrying over the blocks that you have done all along.
Yeah, it is. And the other thing that really happens is that for all the planning of color and dyeing the yarns and looking at the yarns as skeins, you think you have an idea what it's going to look like. But once the skeins become something woven, even though they're entirely west-faced and solid color within their particular block, the way the yarn that's woven relates to the color next to it is different from the way a skein or a ball placed next to each other works. So there's always a little bit of adjustment once you start weaving. You say, well, these colors are not quite what I thought they were going to be next to each other, and so let's maybe think about rearranging them a bit. There was one three-block weaving that I did, in the rug technique, that I would keep changing the cartoon as I wove, because I'd get this and I'd say, oh, that doesn't look right. So I wouldn't undo the weaving. I'd just leave it in there. I'd say, well, let's go back to the computer and make a new sketch. I wound up with a stack, maybe a quarter of an inch of sheets of paper that I'd change from time to time. But the other thing I was going to say about the having done the tapestry houses, then I really became enamored of the house shape as something to explore a lot further. So I did a lot of woven houses for a number of years after that. Having done that very serious piece based on my reaction to the invasion of Iraq, I went on a vacation to northern India and had done a lot of reading and studying of Indian myths and religious ideas. And so had all of that idea in the back of my mind, and then all of the exposure to the textiles and the wonderful different ways of using color that one finds in any other culture than your own. And once you take yourself out of your own culture, you have a lot of inspiration for other ideas. So I came back from that trip and then did a set of 8 houses that were a little bit lighter in idea, that were based on different aspects of Indian mythology and colors that might be associated with that. It's things I've done a number of times, trying to think how to relate color to something you wouldn't naturally relate it to. So the series of 6 kimonos actually wound up with titles that were related to characteristics you wouldn't associate with weavings or kimonos, but maybe those characteristics were somehow evoked by looking at the color combination. So it had one that was nobility, because there were very rich red colors on a gray background. Sagacity, one that was all in different shades of gray. You know, after working with color so much, I said, what would happen if I were to work only with gray colors? So this one is a very stately and noble sort of color combination. Verity, sort of a true blue color. Uh-huh. That nature. So then the Indian houses were related to characteristics of the gods. So the one that was in shades of red was Agni, the fire god, and Tara was a green house, and Krishna, blue. There was one, Mahisa, the buffalo demon, which was in cow colors, buffalo colors.
I was looking at this other paper that you brought, and you have also your basketry that you've been doing, or those are sort of related in that they're working with color, but in a different three-dimensional way. So those are interesting too. When did you start doing those?
This must have been in 2002. I'd taken a workshop, one-day workshop at the Vancouver Convergence with Kate Anderson, who does absolutely incredible knotted linen teapots that look like paintings, that are related to traditional painters' work. I was fascinated with the technique. She, because she wanted a lot of detail in her work, used some very fine wax linen to do all the knotting. Each little spot of color comes about because you've tied one knot with that wax linen, and each one becomes a different thing. Well, I found it slow and tedious, and so I put it away for a long time and didn't do anything with it. But I had some white rug warp linen that I had used for some table runners, for somebody that wanted some table runners. I had some longish thrums left over from that, and this was a lot fatter yarn, and so I got to thinking, well, if I could dye the colors that I wanted instead of being dependent upon the wax linen that was available, and use a little bit larger size thread, this might be something that would be a little bit more in keeping with what I was willing to do in terms of. And I'd always been curious about what would happen if I were to work in 3 dimensions, sort of a natural fit. I worked on that first one for a little bit and made an ovoid shape. I still have. But I got to thinking, what about making cylinders? And so I would start the knotting at the base and then work the way around the form, and then take the support form out of it and have just a freestanding cylinder at the end of it. Well, this really, really intrigued me, because I had originally worked with some painted warp, and so that meant that you wound up getting, because these knots were tied at different places and where they'd been, from where they'd been dyed and came up in different sequence, you wound up getting some patterns that were a big surprise from what one might have thought. And so I've done a lot of playing with that in terms of what kind of patterns can you get from this technique, and how can you manipulate the colors. All of these will start by winding a skein or several skeins, depending on the size of it, which I'll lay out on plastic of some sort and then paint with dye different colors in different areas, and then set the dye and rinse it completely, and then cut one end of the skein. So now I've got long linear segments of the yarn that then can then be used to create the vessel form.
And they're very beautiful, they really are. The ones I've seen are really nice.
One of the outcomes of having done that show in Poland was that I had an invitation from a woman living in Chicago that had originally had been born in Lithuania, married an American man in the 50s, moved to America. And then when the wall went down and former Soviet republics gained their independence, she decided she wanted to go back to her hometown in Lithuania and establish a museum as her gift back to her homeland. She is an artist and a tapestry weaver, and so she wanted as much as possible to exhibit tapestries in her museum. And so she asked me if I would consider doing a show at the museum. And again, after sending the work to Poland had not been terribly easy nor inexpensive because of their requirements. So I hesitated for a while and then finally decided to go ahead and do it. The show was to be in 2007. In 2006, I had the opportunity to take a trip to the grasslands of eastern Tibet and the nomadic areas and visit monasteries, nomads, shaman festivals, and the like, and had a tremendous amount of visual stimulus from that trip. About the same time, I needed to start thinking about putting together a large museum exhibition, all of my work. There were three galleries, and so I wound up doing one, a set that were based on prayer flags, because we saw a lot of fields of prayer flags, and just a very moving idea, that the idea that you would print a prayer on a piece of cloth and then hang that piece of cloth out in the wind, with the wind blowing the prayers onward, gaining merit for you and whatever people that you had put the prayer flag up for. And then the prayer flags would hang out there in the elements until they disintegrated to nothing in the fibers from which they came. So I did one full gallery that was of prayer flags, one with a large tapestry that simulated the written text on a prayer flag, and then a set of five of them in the traditional colors of some prayer flags that mimic the idea of the disintegration. So there were three large rectangular forms, and each one a gray background that started with very intense red, let's say, and then that red slowly faded into something else in the other rectangles. So that was one gallery. Then the other thing that we experienced when we were there is that the nomadic Tibetans had traditionally grazed their herds of yaks from lower elevation to higher elevation as the summer progressed, and so they lived in tents and they had a nomadic lifestyle. But partly because of concerns about overgrazing, but also partly as an idea of controlling people, the government was building houses and trying to settle them and fencing the yard. So the idea of changing of the old ways and having nomads being put into houses, I thought was a sort of a jarring idea. And so that actually became the title for the exhibit, Houses for Nomads. And so I did it for the second gallery. I did a set of 16 houses that were all based on some of the color ideas that we'd seen and named for the places that we had visited on that trip. And then the third gallery, which was really a long hallway that connected the two of them, I lined with some photographs from that trip just to give people an idea and a background from that. Yeah.
It's a really influential trip for you.
I'm lucky to have been able to travel a fair amount, and when I was working full-time, I always said that was the reason to work, so I would be able to travel and do something, see something different. I'm a very firm believer in finding inspiration from exposing yourself to something other than what you're comfortable with, what you normally see. Think of some American Tapestry Alliance newsletter. I'd written an article for creativity, and I said, it doesn't really have to be travel. Just do anything that's out of your normal comfort zone. Go to a different grocery store than you normally go to, or go to some place that you would normally go to, but go with a friend. Or, you know, say go to see a museum exhibit you'd always seen. If you go with someone else, they're going to have a different viewpoint. And just these little things that jolt you out of your normal way of thinking make you consider things differently, and I think it can be a real stimulus to creativity. I've always woven, outside the, even when I was working full time, I would get up early in the morning and weave until I went to work, and then come back from work and weave some more in the evening. So.
I guess we should mention what you actually did as your real job.
Yeah, I was trained as a chemist and later a biochemist. So I got my PhD in biochemistry in 74. And it was actually about the time I started weaving. I think I must have been finishing graduate school and was afraid that I was going to run out of things to do. And so I took up weaving because that was certainly something that would fill up a lot of time.
That's true. It does.
So I did that until about 10 years ago. Then at that point, I realized from that job, I'd saved enough money that I could probably be able to do what I wanted to based on what I had in savings and occasionally sell something.
So you're sort of supporting yourself on... Still from that job.
Yeah, it's still from money that I put away and saved, and mm-hmm. I've been fortunate enough that it's held up and been able to do what I wanted to do. I still travel a little bit.
Yeah, I travel quite a bit. Thank you for talking with me. I really appreciate it, Michael.
Well, Anna, thank you for asking me.
It was nice.
That's all for this episode, and now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.